Pure Script, you can compile that to JavaScript, and then you can run it on Node.js again.
That sounds like you're describing my personal hell. Welcome back to Backend Banter, the show about backend engineering and careers. I'm here today with Sabine. We're going to have another OCaml episode, which I'm extremely excited about. Last time I had TJ on, and I really thought that TJ was the biggest OCaml shill on Twitter, but then I met you and I realized, you know, we needed to do another episode on OCaml. So my first question, just Sabine, how much is big OCaml paying you to constantly shill the language on Twitter?
Well, I would say it's a pretty competitive salary for the area, and considering it's a fully remote job, I'm actually very happy with what Big OCaml is paying me.
I'm just kidding, you don't have to answer that.
No, I won't, but I will just say that I'm happy about it.
No, that's amazing. So you're on the OCaml team. Like, tell me just a little bit about that structure. Like, what does the structure of the OCaml team even look like? How does it work?
So, well, there's not such a thing as the OCaml team. So there's a bunch of things here. So there's the OCaml compiler, which many people and different universities and companies work on and contribute to. But then there's companies like the one I work at, Taridesh, who do a lot of work on the tooling, but also not always alone. And I happen to be a team leader at this company working for the OCaml org team, which is a very small team. So don't expect like there to be a ton of people on this team. This is actually a tiny team, dealing with the official OCaml website.
I'm always interested in people's stories who kind of come to work on these like open source projects. I'd say large. I mean, OCaml's large enough that, like, you know, I used it in school. I heard about it all over the place. It's obviously not the biggest programming language out there, but, you know, becoming a maintainer on a big project like OCaml, OCaml.org, it's a pretty big deal. So I want to just rewind now and, like, let's go kind of walk our way back up through your story to how you landed, you know, working on OCaml. Where did you start? Like, when did you first get started coding? Was it in high school, middle school, or the equivalent of that in Germany?
Well, that was in the, I don't know, like that was in the early 90s. So I got my first computer when I was 7, and it had QBasic, so it was pretty cool.
Wow.
I actually had parents who would drive me to a few classes, and then we would play with that at home. And QBasic had amazing documentation, so you could just like go in the documentation, look at the code examples, and copy these over and just try out things. So later I did a bit of Pascal, I did a little bit of C++, but I was never very obsessively a coder. I was wasting a lot of time playing computer games as a kid. So
you started with QBasic when you were 7.
Yes.
That's really early. I think I like opened an HTML file in Notepad once when I was like 11 or 12, and that was the earliest.
Oh yeah, we did that. We had our own local internet, so we built our own local fake internet, because, you know, like accessing the internet was expensive. You had to dial up. Yeah. You had to pay a lot of money. You had the modems with the funny noises back in the days. So we made our own internet. So we made a fake banking website. We had some JavaScript to do the hover state on the buttons. You had to use JavaScript back in the days.
Yeah, yeah.
It was hilarious.
And this is like when you're, what, 10, 12?
Yeah, something like that. And I had siblings who also enjoyed this kind of playing around with things, inspecting in the browser, seeing how things work.
Yeah. Okay. That's amazing. So you got a really early start with computers.
Yeah, that's very lucky on my part.
Yeah, no, it's it's really cool. A lot of people did. The funny thing is, like, there's luck there, right? Not everybody got started early in computers, but there's also something to be said for, like, you know, a lot of us did have early access to computers, but just, like, weren't that interested. It was kind of a it was kind of a nerdy thing to do, frankly, right? And
yeah.
Turns out it worked out really well for those of us that did kind of lean into the nerdiness.
Well, yeah, when you don't have friends, you just do other things. Like, you know, you play with computers with your siblings, so that's fine.
Yeah. No, that's how it was for me as well. Okay, so what's next? Where do you go as you get older, like, you know, 16,
17, 18? Well, I drop out of school, which leaves me in a position that I couldn't study. And I drop out of school after skipping three grades, after being hailed the gifted kid, and
I was
miserable at school.
Those are, like, conflicting things. Okay, so it's like,
yes.
You say you're the dropout, it's like, ah, dropout, and then you're like, but I skipped
three
grades.
But this is so funny. Like, you know, when you stand between worlds, or, like, you stand in both worlds, one foot in both worlds. which is kind of funny, because this is exactly what I'm doing with the OCaml community, standing with one foot in both worlds, in the academic and in the shipping oriented world.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I dropped out because I couldn't handle school. My family fled to France to avoid school, so we would do fake homeschooling. We would just pretend to not exist.
So you skipped grades, obviously, because you were doing very well in school, like, but then you dropped out because of the was it boring? Was it just, like, a lot of tedious work?
Yes, it was basically agonizingly boring, seeing your time wasted by school.
Yeah,
I was never doing really amazing at school, so I had pretty average grades, except for like math and the hard topics. Or what people claimed were the hard topics, the ones where you had to learn, I was not great. But my mother was always very, very focused on, like, oh, she's just bad, getting not so good grades because she's so bored. So she was very good at arguing this in order to get them to accelerate me. But ultimately, you get put in a very, very bad social position when this happens. You are the youngest in the class. You don't work. Other kids, they say, like, oh, she must be working so hard to do this. Why? Yeah. So why is she such a weirdo? You know, so you eventually get bullied or some such. So
I can only imagine 3 years is a long time when you're a teenager. Like, that's, I had a friend in high school that was a year, like, he skipped one grade and was like in our grade.
It was actually just 2 years, because I entered school 1 year late. I was a very anxious kid.
Got it. So you skipped, you dropped out, and then is there university afterwards? Like, how does that transition even work when you
skip? That's very difficult in Germany. Yeah. That's very difficult in Germany, actually, because you need to have Abitur, so you need to have a diploma in order to even enter university. So I figured I would do an external, I don't know, test, but I failed that one. I failed
oh, no.
that one really badly because I never learned to learn. I just failed that one. Then I spent 2 years playing Diablo 2.
Is it like you were good at learning, but, like, you never learned to study? Because those are kind of different things in my mind.
Yes. Yeah, kind of like you throw me something and I understand that pretty quickly. But studying, why should I study? Or how should I learn studying at school when basically everything is repeated so many times that I don't know.
Yeah, because I had a similar thing, kind of, where, like, I was pretty naturally good at certain subjects. I'm not so good at others. But, like, in high school, learning felt really easy, so I never studied. And then when I got to some of the more advanced classes in university, I actually struggled because I you said, I never really learned to study, and I didn't have good studying habits. And so it was like, looking back on it, I'm like, I think I was like pretty good at learning, at like picking up new concepts and understanding, but I was really bad at studying, and that's kind of a learned skill.
Yeah, that's true. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that I was very lucky when I finally got to university, because my partner would force me to study. Be like, yeah, you have helps. To do the homework. You will do the homework. And that did a lot of good for me, really a lot of good, because at some point things pick up, and when you haven't done the homework, you're lost.
It's easy to forget, like, especially as adults now, where like as an adult you're never really forced to learn anything. As a kid, you're constantly forced to learn things, like in the sense that there's a lot of pressure, right? There's a lot of social pressure to get good grades. Sometimes there's even financial pressure when you're a young adult, like in university, because you're paying, so it's expensive. So it's like financial pressure, social pressure.
Oh yeah, this is a very much US thing with the financial pressure.
Yeah,
so
that's
true. In Germany,
true.
we do pretty much free university, which is wonderful. But yeah,
that's yeah. True. But my point just being that there's these pressures, and I think later sometimes when you're trying to like self-pace, it can be easy to forget that the pressure helps. So like in your case, it sounds like you had a little bit of social pressure from your partner, and that can be helpful in some ways.
Yes, that was extremely helpful. I don't think I would have done well in university without that.
Yeah. Okay, so you get to university and are you studying computer science?
Yes, so I started computer science in a program aimed at kids that were still at school, still preparing for their diploma.
Okay.
I managed to sneak in there and was allowed to take lectures and get credit for the lectures. And I just happened to end up being a straight A student mostly. So
oh, wow.
I think like
okay.
top three of the class, and I was putting in the work, you know, I was putting in the work the first time in my life. I worked harder than I worked on Diablo 2 farming for unique items. And that's actually where I learned work ethic. So like having to put in work to get something.
Wait, you learned the work ethic in Diablo 2?
In Diablo 2, yes. Yes, very much so.
That's an interesting take. Okay. Just grinding for items, huh?
Yeah, like, you know, you just have to, right, you have to do it. If you want it, you have to do it. And that helped me in university also, like seeing, oh yeah, you have to, you want this, you have to do this. And turns out that getting good grades in university is another fast track in life. So I had dropped out of my old fast track and I got on a new fast track. By better getting picked up in the university's gifted program,
yeah,
which is kind of lucky way of going through life when you get these kind of connections that they offer,
right.
offer you when you get into such a program.
Okay, so it's, you got fast tracked in university, and then what do you do upon graduation?
Right, I don't know what to do. So after master's degree, I stick around for a PhD and just doing like what I'm told more or less, because I figure that, yeah, I'm on a good track here. I should be doing this, but in a sense, I was not very, very happy either. The PhD I did was very externally motivated. So it was in a research project. So there was a lot of like pressure, structure, a lot of requirements. So it was not the kind of open-ended PhD that you would do in the States.
So you say it was external, like, do you mean like there was a company sponsoring it and so there were like requirements and expectations, or do you just mean, well, I don't know what you mean. Tell me what
yeah,
you
so
mean.
We were in a research project with Microsoft Research. So the scope of the PhD was pretty much determined.
Got it. Okay, that's interesting. I don't have a PhD, so I'm always, I've had several people with PhDs on the pod, and I'm always asking questions like, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, so I don't know. So as I understand it, some PhDs are more like, okay, you have a certain interest and you follow these kind of interests until you have enough for a PhD, until you have discovered something useful and you published about that. And mine was not at all like that. And I I don't know. I was kind of disillusioned with academia or with the prospect of now
kind of sounds like going on to
publish or perish. Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
I was just not looking forward to the prospect of publishing or perishing until getting tenure or something. And I didn't feel I fit in there very well.
Got it. So what happened? Did you finish the project? What?
Well, I got a kid and then I finished, wrote down the PhD with a baby on my lap and spent another year part-time as a postdoc, but ultimately I had the opportunity to go to Carnegie Mellon research fellowship. So I actually wrote a successful proposal for a research fellowship that was granted.
Really? Okay.
Yes. But then I did not go.
You're like, no. Okay. Was it because of your kid?
Just thinking of, mostly because of the kid. Just looking at the kind of work ethic you're expected to show in the U.S., compared to here.
Is it higher or lower?
And having a baby with that is like the worst time, the worst time in life if you want to spend the time with a baby.
That makes sense. Wait, so do you perceive the worth ethic in the US as like, are the demands higher or the expectations higher?
Yes, I think so. So the exploitation of grad students from what I hear is pretty strong in the US.
I haven't been a grad student, but
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, always relying on the free food. It's probably better when you have a funded research fellowship anyways, but...
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Grad students. Yeah, I've heard horror stories again. Like I was never a graduate student, but my understanding is it's like minimum wage server type work, like it just
it's
almost
not
internship.
That bad in Germany, and in Germany we got a decent enough salary actually.
When
you study computer science and are at a university that has funding, you have a pretty good chance to have an assistant position at the chair, to do some work on the lectures and organizing the tutors and stuff like that. So I wasn't starving.
Got it. Okay, so it's better in Germany. Now, okay, so you decide not to move to the States and pursue that. How do we go from, like, what's the next step in this journey towards OCaml and functional programming?
So the next step is becoming, first dropping out of the postdoc and saying like, yeah, no, I'm gonna take care of the baby. But taking care of babies is notoriously boring and like the most dullest thing you can imagine. Like, okay, yes, you sleep a lot, you breastfeed a lot, you feed, you sleep. And at some point I was so bored and found some time to go back to one of these old multi-user dungeon games I used to play as a kid. So these kind of telnet games where people do role playing and fighting monsters and stuff. And I spent a few months coding for that. They had a backlog of some 5,000 issues, and I think I closed around 2,000 of them.
Wow.
A lot of those were things where you just looked at the issue and you checked whether it works or not, and you would just close the issue. But there were also real interesting bugs to fix there. And
wait, so I want to pause on this for a second. Yeah, this is really cool. So there's this game. Is it an online, like, so it's,
yeah,
an open,
it's
source
still
game?
Online. The game is still online, actually. It's called Accursed Lands.
Accursed Lands. Okay. What language was the game written in?
LPC. So it's an LP mod. So this is basically one of the spiritual predecessors of Erlang, as I understand.
Okay.
So you have a system where you have all these players running around in a world. Things can crash at runtime, but the system is robust against these kind of processes crashing, and it will restart the processes, respawn the NPCs, all these kind of things. So.
Wow. Okay. So, but instead of just playing the game,
no, I became a wizard on this game. I became a wizard on this game to build stuff. Since playing the game was no longer in so interesting for me, it was.
Yeah. I imagine. So I always tell people that like finding projects that you're really interested in is a great way to not just like practice coding, but like actually start shipping stuff that people use, which can look good on resumes and lead to career opportunities. Did working on that project like lead into your first professional developer job? Like, was it helpful in any way?
Yeah, I think so. It was very helpful in a way because it helped me see that, well, you can do things like even after being for several years in a graduate student position where I did not really code or some such, I can still do it. Oh well, I can learn it. Like it is mind bending still. But I can learn it. I can do things that people care about, and people would recognize that as something useful.
Yeah.
But at some point, I also figured like, okay, yeah, well, this is just playing around. So you're gonna do something else now.
Yeah. So what was the something else? What was after this game?
The something else was getting into sewing and into wanting to build a website for people who sew.
Did this? Okay. So this is fascinating to me. So you're into coding, specifically coding on a game that you enjoyed. Now, was it that you also happens to like sewing and so you wanted to code for a sewing thing, or was it just the coding? Okay, it was the first.
Well, kind of. This is a very good question. Because yeah, I did a little bit of sewing, but I think I liked the idea of sewing more than the actual sewing. and coding, that was something that I really liked to do. And at some point I figured like, okay, what's my biggest problem with sewing that I would want to solve? And the bigger problem was that I have not very non-standard body proportions. So these kind of sewing patterns, so the blueprints from which you cut the clothes and sew them together, they just wouldn't work for me very well, actually pretty badly. So I figured like, oh yeah, so is there a technical approach to fix that? And I searched and I found like, oh yeah, people generate sewing patterns to measurements. So yes, that's possible. Oh, then let's do a platform with an editor where people can design these sewing patterns and sell them to each other or share them with each other. But turns out that like when you have zero front-end experience, it's not a good idea to want to do to build essentially a CAD application. So it's not a good idea. Yeah.
3D graphics rendering engine. Yeah, I can see how.
Yeah,
that would
well,
be
even if it all just stays 2D and you have a lot of calculations there, a lot of SVG. Well, at this point, SVG wasn't even that ready yet.
Yeah,
that was 2014. So a lot of different times.
It's funny that you bring this up because so my whole family of in-laws are extremely into sewing. And in particular, my sister-in-law approached me in the very classic, like, oh, you're a developer. I have an idea for an app sort of way. And it was, we need to build an app for sewing for people who sew, right? And the idea was something very similar. It was like, oh, I have all these patterns on paper, and if only I could put them in an app, and if only it could do all these calculations for me. My suspicion was that there are either A, are apps out there that do this, or B, it's actually like an extremely tricky problem to solve in a useful way. Did you run into either
so
of those
it's
things?
Answer B. It's answer
it's B.
Okay. Yeah. So, yes. I mean, there's a lot of potential, specifically with large language models and training them in order to fit closes. I think there's a lot of potential here, but this is definitely not the kind of thing, at least at that point, that you would do as a solo dev wanting to bootstrap something. So you just don't.
That's interesting that you mentioned LLMs. Do you mean like you could just like type out your measurements really quickly and maybe have it generate some sort of output that you could then feed into like a graphical interface?
No, I'm thinking more like you would consume existing patterns. So load in these existing sewing patterns, load in the pattern pieces, and then have the thing scale things in a way that they fit your body.
Ah, okay.
So based on how your body differs from the standard measurements, and taking into account like factors like what is aesthetically good looking, because that's the hard problem in pattern making, in sewing pattern making and designing clothes, that you want to create some proportions that are perceived as good looking, and which is a very vague requirement.
Yeah, it's but you're saying makes sense. Like maybe if you have a model that's been like told enough by millions of people what looks good, there's potential there. Yeah,
those kind of things.
That makes sense. So what happened with the project? Did you actually spin it up and then like launch it to like Crickets or where to go?
No, not that one. So I pretty early realized that this is out of my ballpark. So as a beginner front end dev, this was out of my ballpark, and I came across a blog post that changed my life, and it was called "Why Is There No Ravelry for Sewing?" So obviously. And it had tons of comments of people saying, like, yeah, there should be a revelry for sewing.
What's revelry? I don't know what this is.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I go. So I see, like, wait, everyone is wanting this kind of revelry for sewing. So what is this? So I went and I found that Revelry is a website for people who knit and crochet. And it's kind of a pattern database and stash organization tool where people record all the patterns they own, where there's a huge database of all patterns known to anyone, more or less, and all
humanity.
The books that contain patterns. Yeah, by now I would say pretty much. And also all the magazines that contain patterns, and you could search for patterns that have certain criteria, could search all the sweater patterns, all the scarf patterns, and search for any kind of features on those. Very detailed database, like basically the dream of anyone who loves spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. Like the person who does spreadsheets recreationally at home, they absolutely would love this. And yeah, so when you see that and you're like, oh yeah, I love this search. I love that people collecting all this data. This is wonderful. This is like, oh, it's a dream. And actually then seeing that this is built by one person, so one coder, so not alone, but as a single developer, then you think like, well, I mean, they always said we're brilliant, so maybe we can do this.
Yeah.
But for sewing. And turns out that, well, not quite.
Are there interesting challenges with sewing?
Yes, there's some very different challenges in terms of like how people want to search and what kind of things people care about. And people care a lot more about measurements in sewing, and they care a lot more about style features on the garments when sewing. And well, and I still was a front-end developer with no experience. So,
right.
I had never used an SQL database in production. But I figured I'd do it anyway. And I started with Python Django and hacked together something. I had no idea of UX, so I did a very, very ugly things that I got feedback from my interested testers on, who told me like, yeah, no, this is not going to work this way. And I was refactoring a lot. So I learned a ton about refactoring. I was in a sense in a lucky position. I was at home. I was taken care for. I was not starving.
Yeah. So I had a similar experience with Python and Django. It was my first like web project, Python and Django. And I struggled with a lot of things. UX, UI, CSS was a huge gap. I was terrible. I also just struggled with understanding, kind of like you said, it had been my first time like deploying SQL to production. I had no idea how anything was working under the hood. Like it all felt magical. Like I was in my CS degree at the time. So like I felt like I understood, you know, logic and programming, in particular, like procedural programming. But Django to me felt like just a configuration beast of like, well, I just have to configure all these things properly, and then if I cross my fingers, it'll work. What did you learn in the project? Like, what were some of the, unique challenges that you ran into with this first web project?
Well, unique. I think most of the challenges I ran into were anything but unique, but mostly user error. And in a sense of like when you're this kind of person who's used to being able to like fake your way through everything.
Yeah.
But you really get onto this challenge, and now you have to build something, and you want to build something, right? Because it's a challenge, because it's meaningful, and because you just want to. So the thing I found is I had to learn a lot. I really just had to learn a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
It changed me entirely in how I look at other people's work as well. Simply because you have a lot more humility when you've been there and you've struggled and you've seen what it takes.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Now, before we started chatting offline, I'd mentioned that recently I had Carson Gross on the podcast, the creator of HTMX.
Mm-hmm.
And that in this project, this Django Python project that you've been building, you'd actually been introduced to HTMX predecessor Intercooler.js.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Pretty good. So at some point, I looked at what I was building, and I looked at other social networks. So I looked at LinkedIn. And LinkedIn had this feature where you had these sections and you could press on a little edit button, and then it made the section editable, and you could edit your data and save it without reloading the whole page. And for some reason, I found that cool, and I wanted to do the same thing. And so I did the same thing.
That's because it,
and I found,
in like kind
and I found
standard...
Intercooler.js for that, so which actually worked pretty well already. So.
And is that because in like kind of default Python Django like templating language, you're doing like full server renders of the page every time you post a form?
Yeah, you do the full page reload, you on edit. And that isn't even bad. But at this time, this was a cool new thing, like, you know, interactively without reloading the page and not necessarily even having a client server application, because at this time there was a very strong belief spread around in terms of like, oh, you cannot offload this rendering to the client side. You will drain your people's, your users' batteries. It will be horribly slow. And yeah, I tried Angular. I tried Ember. And I didn't get it. So.
Yeah, I think we like simultaneously have overestimated actually how computationally expensive rendering is. Like, it's actually not that bad. And I think we've also maybe overestimated how bad full page loads are. They're also not that bad. There's there's extremes of that. Like, there's certainly applications where page loads are not good and you don't want to be doing that. But like, I think in the typical CRUD app, it's actually just not that big of a deal.
Yes, exactly. Except like when you have someone telling you like they are data entry professional and they're telling you your UI is not fast enough.
Yeah.
Then you're like, oh yeah, you need to figure out how to do this kind of thing, but it's not like HTMX would help you there. Or
what's the relationship between Intercooler and HTMX? Are they basically the same thing, just rebranded? Or?
I think they do have some differences, but I don't remember so well anymore, like what yeah. Intercooler.js was like. So I would have to look that up entirely. But the entire concept of declaratively adding attributes to the HTML and then having things happen by that, like fetching HTML from the server and injecting that into the template, replacing, swapping out, that was already still there. That was very close to the experience we have now.
That makes sense. So it's kind of, yeah, it sounds like it's almost like the V0 of HTMX.
Yeah, kind of.
That's been my perception of it, at least so far. Okay, cool. So you used Intercooler. You built this project. How did you go from working on a sewing project by yourself to getting hired at your first dev job?
Yeah, actually, Tari, this is my first dev job, my first actual job.
Yeah.
Which is kind of hilarious. Like, I mean, people on Twitter, they're treating me like an expert, and the expertise comes mostly from my own hacking on things and figuring out things and building this same social network prototype in different languages and frameworks, which I don't know. I mean, yes, maybe there is expertise, but I don't have a lot of expertise in actually deploying to production. So the only thing I deployed to production was this Django app, and it was horrible. yeah, but anyways, it's so horrible. It's actually embarrassingly horrible. Though it does some of the things I wanted it to do.
So is mine. Every Django app I've ever made is embarrassingly horrible, and I've hid them all away where no one.
Yeah. So at some point when building this Django application, so I was chaining together jQuery, all kinds of front end libraries. It was a true Frankenstein monster. So at some point I realized, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm building a golden cage. To be trapped in refactoring this Python and maintaining this mess I created. I figured that, no, actually languages should have types. I'm shooting myself in the foot all the time because in a refactoring, I don't have any support from the compiler. Back in the days, Python did not have good type systems.
Using debuggers and print statements to figure out what the hell is inside a variable. I've been there.
Yes. Yeah, but that works. That's fine. I mean,
yeah, it's just slow, is my experience. But
yeah,
that's
true. I mean, in Python, specifically in Python, with a Django app, that is slow. On a laptop, that is slow.
Yeah. So you decided you like types. What did you do with this discovery of type
languages?
Yes,
with this discovery, I first tried Node.js with TypeScript, but I found this so weird. So this whole callback hell, I did not want no part of this callback hell. So I quickly moved on after trying a few virtual DOM libraries. Then I got to Elm. So I figured, like, oh yeah, let's try something more foundational, something more functional. I had a pretty nice experience.
Like a postdoc
Elm,
would,
actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's very postdoc branded, so. But it's actually a good language. It's actually very, very simple. It's just like a state machine.
It looks interesting to me. Like, so let me give you my understanding of Elm, and you can tell me where I'm wrong, and hopefully it'll also bring the audience up to speed a little bit. My understanding of Elm is basically you've got like your Elm program and it treats like the whole front end of your application as like, think of it as like a snapshot of state. So I've got like my state for the application. I run it through my Elm function because this is like a functional program that's essentially a giant function tree, and it spits out and like renders on the page something, and then something else happens and now my state's modified. I feed that state back into my Elm program, it spits out a new rendered page, and every time
this happens,
is that like a high level overview of it?
Kind of, yeah. So yes, in Elm you have this one centralized state and you operate over that. Anytime you change the state, it goes via a message. So you cannot mutate the state without a message. And the beautiful consequence of that is that you can have a time travel debugger. So when you run the Elm debugger and you inspect that in the browser, you can go back step by step to the previous points in the interaction that you had, and you can see where did you go off rails? Where did something go wrong? And this is pretty cool.
That is cool. Yeah. So did you stick with Elm or did you move on?
Well, no, I eventually I figured like, okay, well, yeah, this is just front end on the one hand side. And what I really need is like, I need something that also works on the back end. And I ideally in a way that it's the same language so I can share some code like form validation and stuff like that. So I was aiming far too high. Like I was aiming for things no single person should aim for alone. You should have a team for that. So I tried a PureScript for a little bit, but I got too confused by the many types in the PureScript Halogen framework. So
isn't that also front end only, or does it have a
back-end? That's front end only, but PureScript you can compile that to JavaScript and then you can run it on Node.js again.
Ah, That sounds like you're describing my personal hell. I've done some pure scripts, and compiling pure script to JavaScript just to run it on the back end sounds like the worst time in the world to me.
Yeah. Right. So I just spend a brief time there. So there were some things I liked about pure script and others that just confused me, where I felt like, okay, Elm does it so much simpler. Like, I like simplicity.
Yeah.
The point in writing a system that is maintainable is to keeping it as simple as you can. And
That was Carson Gross's tweet this morning. Daily update to remember that if it magically works, it can also magically break, right? The complexity, the toll of complexity.
Yeah, that's very true. Yes.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Yeah, where did you go next?
No, anyways, from there, I moved on to Haskell. Haskell was kind of almost, so I had to go through the Monad Wrangler. Basically, I went through the Monad Wrangler. That was fine. Then I could write some Haskell. I still don't entirely intuitively have the correct intuition for like Monad transformers and such, but I could follow the instructions and set up web frameworks and database libraries and such. So that was fine. It was a pretty fine language. But what ultimately put me off a little was the huge bundle size for the generated JavaScript. So for the Haskell to JavaScript compiler. So I just couldn't see myself shipping a megabyte of JavaScript. That was not
just
what I wanted.
Just 1 meg? Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, well, with a more complex application, obviously more. But
I get what you mean. Like, very simple application, you're already at a meg. I get that.
Yeah, right. And that for me was a bit of a deal breaker, unfortunately, because at this point I wanted to share code between the front end and the back end. And I was like, well, this is not practical for me when I want this to load in people's phones on a slow connection. I mean, I wanted it to load because obviously, if your page doesn't load, they go away.
Yeah. That is unfortunate when that does happen.
This is just how it goes. I mean, I go away when the page loads for more than 3 seconds. I'm gone because they don't have patience.
You're lucky if people give you 3 seconds, in my experience.
I know.
It's like, yeah, one.
It's very gracious of me.
I think I usually give people a whole second before giving up.
Yeah, see, and that's about the expectation that people have now.
Yeah. Okay, so you did the Haskell thing. It just turned out to be a little slow in production. What's next?
Well, while I did the Haskell thing, I also write a little Haskell library, little template Haskell library, which possibly proved to be useful. So I wrote something for persistent Haskell that would automatically add, updated, so auditing columns to the database tables.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
Which turned out to be quite nice to do in template Haskell. So people always said, like, template Haskell, it's so hard. And well, not for this particular thing that I did. I don't know. Maybe I was just lucky choosing a thing that was simple.
In my experience, anything with I.O. in Haskell is hard.
Yeah, that didn't require I.O. So
okay.
That was actually
manipulating strings
nice
in memory.
Haskell.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Yeah, at some point then I said, like, no, I have to give up this irrational dream. I have to, like, get somewhere. I kind of have to stop doing this because it's unhealthy.
You did. This is like the joke that we've made on this podcast so many times about, like, never shipping Haskell to production. You truly lived it, not just with Haskell, but with the other functional programming languages as well.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. And now I this is such a great honor to be shipping OCaml into production. It's kind of like, okay, wow, you can ship.
You tried every functional programming language. It finally landed on the one that actually
No, not everyone. Not at all. So I was not this crazy. I was not this dedicated to trying many, but I was aiming for the ones that had community and that had a little bit of ecosystem at the very least. Because three is all nice of them. About like, Python.
It's you pretty much got them all.
Yeah, obviously Python's ecosystem is a bit of a shit pile sometimes with all of these libraries that people publish in order to look good for getting hired. The kind of code that no one ever looks into. At some point, you recognize them, but
yeah. It's obvious when something is not done for a real reason, right? That's why I always try to tell people, like, if you're trying to get into the industry, the best thing you can do is try to do something that's actually useful, because it's obvious when it's just a toy, right? Or it's obvious when it's just done to put on a resume. It's like, yes, you need to build something so you can put it on your resume, but you shouldn't build it so you can put it on your resume. Yeah. If that makes sense, right? Like,
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So I was never building for a resume because I figured, like, oh, I'm unemployable anyway, so why should I care about this?
We can't go any farther down than here. We're already at the bottom.
Yeah, so exactly. We can't go any further. But then on a chance, like, I came across a job ad in a forum, I think, in some kind of news group forum for women in programming.
Okay.
And Taridas, I think Taridas was hiring someone, looking for a woman. So I'm actually also a diversity hire.
Hey, we take those. If it works, it works. Yeah.
If it works, it works, right.
Cool. So you got picked up by Taridas specifically to work on what?
Well, actually to work on compiling OCaml to WebAssembly, because I had the kind of PhD background, the kind of academic credentials that would suggest that maybe I'm the person who can do this. And I did spend a lot of time on digging up information, collecting information on this, and going to the WebAssembly meetings of the garbage collection WebAssembly group in order to, I don't know, do some light lobbying for OCaml.
Some light lobbying. I love that.
Well, actually, I was supposed to build prototypes for OCaml to WebAssembly backends. But this turned out to be very hard with kids at home. And very briefly after I got into Taridas, the pandemic started. So the kids were at home all the time. It was just a nightmare. I don't know if I could have done it at this point because it was not my interest. So it was not the thing I wanted to do, writing this kind of deep infrastructure. I mean, it's wonderful. Someone has to do it, but I wasn't the person anymore.
So you did it for a little while, and then you decided it wasn't for you, and then what happened?
Yeah, so actually I kind of low-key dropped off. I was a contractor anyway, so I was part-time. The briefing was I can work as much or as little as is feasible for me, and for the pandemic, eventually I didn't work. So I was at home with the kids.
Yeah.
I ended up starting another attempt of another prototype.
This time in OCaml?
No.
No?
Absolutely not. Okay. At this point, because I did not know OCaml. Yeah, I just knew, like, oh yeah, okay, these guys are trying to make OCaml popular. I was kind of still skeptical, to be honest.
These guys are just OCaml shills.
But no, they're not OCaml shills. So they are actually building the tooling and the stuff that is needed to make it succeed. But
okay, very cool. Yeah.
But after Haskell, I wasn't just very, very trusting of these kind of functional languages with tiny communities. So I went for Rust, obviously.
Yeah, as one does.
Yeah, as one does. Yes, obviously. Yeah, obviously. You go for Rust when you want to
ship. You have played the programming game on extreme difficulty your entire life, is what I'm learning.
That's true. I never had a mentor or anything like that. So I went into ICQ chat rooms. I looked at code of others. I'm very self-sufficient. Maybe to the point of that I shouldn't be so self-sufficient and should maybe like go out more and ask people more, even though it may make me look stupid. This is another thing. Well, like when you come from academia, you really have to overcome this kind of fear of looking stupid.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, I actually think that, to be honest, most people lean too far the other way. of trying to take the easy road. Yeah.
Oh yeah, the easy road. Yeah.
When like.
Yeah. No. Fuck the easy road. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Like I've met so many people that like without even a starting point will just ask like super vague questions in communities. Like, how do I learn Python? It's like, come on. Like you could spend at least a little time researching.
You just do a project. I don't know.
I mean, like, I don't want to discourage people from asking questions. I run a community where people ask questions. It's great. But, like, got to ask specific questions. You got to put in some work, right? You may have taken it in the other extreme. But there's good things about doing research on you, and you learn a lot.
Yeah,
okay, apparently. So what happened with your Rust project?
Well, I had a Rust backend and a SvelteKit frontend.
Okay.
So going with a hot tech that was on the rise, but with a significantly large community, so the kind of decision that you could defend in business.
Yeah, okay.
And I found SvelteKit pretty cool, actually. But when you go for two languages that are different on the front end and back end, mm-hmm. you always have the problem of like connecting them. You have so much opportunity for making mistakes with your APIs not matching up, your calls from the front end not matching up with what the handlers on the back end provide. So that's a wonderful rabbit hole to go down to. So what do? You write some code generation to generate you some API bindings for the front end, a TypeScript, obviously, because mm-hmm. SvelteKit and TypeScript, that's workable.
Yeah,
and for the back end, write you some code gen, use some handlers, wrapping the handlers from the back end web framework in a way that is entirely type safe. I'm pretty happy with that one. So
that's
a good rabbit hole to go down to, because it doesn't suck as much as OpenAPI.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yes, you've been. You fell into that. I looked at Swagger and such, and I couldn't. I couldn't.
So my career for the most part has been almost exclusively Go development on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of Python, a little bit of Node, but mostly Go. And it's this exact problem, right? Which is I write extremely type safe code on my back end, but the minute I want to transfer data to the front end, I have to do it via JSON and JavaScript, which is not strongly typed. So to be honest, like for example, at Boot Dev right now, we're going on the back end, TypeScript on the front end. We just have not done the tight coupling. And it's not the end of the world, but it would be nice to have the type safety. And
yeah.
So we're looking into what we're probably going to do is have some kind of code generation that generates TypeScript interfaces for all of our handlers. And then we can import those on the front end.
That works wonderfully, actually.
Which like, yeah, works great. But it's like this extra step. Right, so I get
right. It's an extra step. It's more code to maintain. So you want your code gen to be as simple as possible. Actually, a wonderful use case for OCaml, as I've recently found porting my code gen to OCaml. So my code gen was originally written in TypeScript. Since I was using TypeScript in the front end, it made sense to just not introduce more languages. So you just
right.
keep with TypeScript, model the API spec in TypeScript, and then generate front end TypeScript bindings, back end Rust wrappers. Actually, I went to Startup Weekend and I found some guys to play Startup with for a while, like really play Startup in a sense. And the other guy, he was a Go developer.
So
I changed my code gen to also emit backend Go wrappers for Gorilla, which he was very, very happy with. So he was new. So it was his first web backend he wrote, and now he works at a company and he says, well, the thing we use at the company, it's so much worse than your code gen. And I was like, oh my god, that was so sweet.
For people who have not worked at actual companies or large companies, I feel like one of the things that is the biggest slap in the face is like, you have no idea as a junior dev just how bad the code at like companies that are making millions of dollars is. Because like developer experience, good code, clean code do not directly correlate to successful business. And so like you'll go get hired
not.
In that
this,
first job and you'll
orthogonal.
Be like, this is a shit show. Like my toy project had better DX. It's like, yeah, well, you know, it's easy to have good DX with a toy project.
Yeah, right. Exactly. When you're doing this for fun and when you're taking the time to do it properly, obviously that's going to be different than in a rush job where people put a prototype in production and then they have users and they cannot waste the time to fix this up. And it's, I have very little experience with that, to be honest. But not everything is beautiful in OCaml land. So we also have bad code bases. We have great code bases and we have bad code bases, like everywhere. This is practical engineering. So.
Yeah. So how did you go from this Rust SvelteKit project to actually being on the OCaml team?
Yeah, this is... But it has nothing to do with the Rust and SvelteKit project, definitely.
Ah, okay.
But at some point, Tari just reached out and was like, "Oh yeah, now the pandemic is over. Maybe you want to come back." And I was like, "Yeah, I want to come back because I was already getting burned out again on my side project." It's like I can do like 8 months or so, and then I'm ruined. My head is full, and I can't do anymore.
Yeah.
But they asked me like, "Oh yeah, you want to come back?" And I was like, "Oh yes, I want to come back." And I got put on the compiler runtime to do some work on the compiler runtime in order to ease me into generating WebAssembly.
Got it.
So
okay,
I did a bit of that, but I didn't really feel at home in the compiler runtime, so it was not my thing. At some point, I had a critical career conversation. But where I told people like, "Hey guys, I can't do this. It's not working. I'm not the person you need for this."
Yeah.
But I am a person who could fix up your shitty website. Well, not like this. I said it much more nicely because I'm actually a nice person when I'm not talking shit. So
nice when not on
like
Twitter.
Like on Twitter, on Twitter I'm talking a lot of shit. So
it's the only way to do Twitter.
I'm actually usually pretty nice.
So what's
but
the
relationship? I told people that I've been seeing the website language and I have the skills to fix that. So there was stuff like broken layouts, alignment problems, styling problems, problems with button sizes, the kind of UX thing I had been struggling so hard for so long to learn properly. Mm-hmm.
That you finally picked it up.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I started with Bootstrap and CSS and then went over different frameworks, just always changing, redesigning until I wrote my own CSS from scratch in ZAS. So.
Wow. I had a very similar story. Like when I was in school, like my CS degree, I was probably one of, if not the worst, one of the worst, like UI UX designers, like not even like the worst at writing the code, but also the worst with like an eye for it. Like thinking things look okay when they really truly don't. And I kind of pride myself on like, now I actually feel like I've gotten to a decent place. I'm still not like a world-class designer by any means. There's this really great book called Refactoring UI that I read that I think helped a lot. It's like UI for developers. Lots of, like,
for me, it was something else. So for me, it was the Gary Simon videos.
Gary Simon.
So there's this guy, a design course, the design course guy. He has a bunch of YouTube videos where he does rapid redesigns. So I have to shill him because he's so cool.
Actually, you know what? I think I've seen one or two of the YouTube videos. I need to, I'll check this out.
It's like this kind of thing where he redesigns 36 websites in an hour and you don't get bored. So usually when people try to teach me something in a YouTube video, I get bored and I click away. But this guy, he speeds it up and then he talks why he's changing that. And this is changes everything for me.
Really cool. Design course. My entire career was just in backend, but in order to launch boot dev and have my own project, like, you got to write some CSS at some point.
Or you have to pay someone for it.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. I'll definitely check that out. Okay, so you started doing UI UX. Was that for OCaml.org?
Well, like in what sense? So on OCaml.org, I do pretty much everything from features, feature additions, changing the backend, the front end, fixing up problems. And now I've actually become a bit more of a maintainer, opening issues for people to contribute on.
So Tardis is a company.
Yes.
And they are, explain to me the relationship between them and like the OCaml programming language, because like every programming language is like sponsored and maintained in a different way. How does that work?
Yeah. So Tardis does a lot of work on the OCaml compiler, but even more so on the OCaml tooling. So things like Dune, Package Manager, OPAM, and all kinds of other things like OCaml format, auto formatter, LSP server, editor integration, these kind of things. So that's a lot of what Tardis does.
Gotcha.
Tardis does a few other things, but primarily this kind of work gets funded by Jane Street. So Tardis does a lot of tooling development for Jane Street, and Jane Street also funds community projects that Tardis does on the OCaml tooling for the wider OCaml community.
Got it. Okay, very cool. So just by being hired by Tardis, you're very close to the whole OCaml ecosystem.
Yeah, it's like a miracle. I mean, I don't know how I got here, except that it's kind of chance.
Yeah,
being in the right place at the right time, knowing the things that they needed for OCaml.org.
Yeah, no, that seems to have worked out really well. Now, I want to ask you a couple questions about the language itself, because we spent a good amount of time on the story, which I thought was fascinating. No, like, I'm so glad we did. Like, you don't get stories like that getting into programming, postdoc, dropping out, skipping 3 years of school, like, so fascinating.
Yeah, I keep thinking, like, I live my life as if someone should make a movie about it.
That's a good way to do it. It gets you on the podcast.
Maybe. I don't know. At least there's no regrets, you know? At least there's no regrets.
Yeah. So anything at the language level that you like don't like and wish it was done a different way?
Well, I mean, there's things lacking, like debug printing.
Hmm.
But that's kind of a thing that could be added and should be added, and like more easy debug printing.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Like, it's just hard to print in line. Is that what you mean?
You have these kind of algebraic data types where you kind of have these sum types and such, but they don't come with a built-in way to print them. So that's all that they would have to add in the compiler.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So right now we're using a lot of like deriving in order to generate functions that allow to render any type to a string. That mm-hmm. works, but you have to manually annotate the deriving. And you have to, for that, you have to install a PPX. It's not as integrated yet as Rust in this regard. But it's possible. I mean, it's possible.
What's the one thing you like most about OCaml? What would you not want to change?
Well, this is a good question. So one thing I would not want to change is the type system. So it's really pretty well done, and specifically the type inference. So many times you don't have to annotate a function with types because the compiler can figure it out. So when you're prototyping something and you're playing around with the design and changing things around a lot, this is pretty nice to not have to update types in too many places at the same time while you are still changing things a lot. Later when you finalize that and you say like, oh yeah, this is good, this is done, then you have your type definitions in a separate interface file. So that you do have type annotations for all of the functions, which also acts pretty well as documentation.
In TypeScript, the like return value is often inferred from a function, right? Like, well, it's always inferred if you want it to be, basically, right? Like you just return stuff, and then TypeScript will see what you returned and like use that as the return type, but it doesn't really do it for parameters. Is that the same? Is it like the same system in OCaml, or is it a little different?
No, it also infers types for parameters, so it's stronger.
Based on all the places it was called in your whole program?
Yeah. But usually,
that's bonkers
like,
to me.
OCaml is a pretty explicit language in a sense. So like, it's not like when you want to do something more abstract, you usually do that intentionally, and then you okay. have a type that is intentionally like has a type variable or something like that.
I'm trying
so,
to like
I don't know.
In my
it's
mind
hard to
how
describe.
It works. Like yeah,
it's hard
so,
to
like,
describe.
Let me give an example. So, like, mm-hmm. let's say I have a function that in the body kind of expects that its parameters, let's say it just has two parameters, are integers. Like, it's adding them together or something. Well, is this even a good example? And then, like, you call
no, this
I
is not a good
function...
example because in OCaml, the addition operator plus is just for integers. So it will know immediately that it's for integers because OCaml has a separate addition operator for floats. So there is nothing to generalize here in OCaml.
Well, actually, but that is interesting. So if I use the addition operator in a function, it will just assume then that the parameters are integers and use that to do the inference.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. Because like I'm pretty sure TypeScript doesn't do that. It just assumes they're any, right? Granted, the plus operator works
I mean,
for everything
in TypeScript,
in JavaScript.
The default is any. TypeScript is insane in that regard, but it has to be. It has to be. And and I don't use any. I don't use any in TypeScript. It makes me anxious. Because it kind of like breaks the entire shell. Like suddenly your protection is
it's kind of gone. Yeah, I mean, I've never had the luxury of not being able to use any because every project I've worked on in TypeScript has been like slowly being migrated to TypeScript from JavaScript. So you start with a code base of all anys, and then over time you're slowly removing some and getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah, but that's good. I mean, that's where TypeScript works, you know? That's why the anys.
That's why it's
the anys are useful, this gradual typing. So I don't necessarily think that gradual typing generally is a good idea, but it's a great scheme for getting JavaScript developers learn a statically typed language.
Yes.
So it's a great way to onboard existing projects into this thinking of like, oh yeah, static types are actually useful.
Yeah, no,
it did a lot of good
more.
In it's... this regard.
Yeah, well, and it's super productive, at least for us. Even if it's just adding interfaces to all of our API calls, like that alone is like the biggest benefit in our project, and it's
documentation essentially. Like you can click through and then you see the type definition and you see like, okay, this is what it looks like. It's helpful. I find it helpful.
Cool. One last question for you about like the engineering stuff. What's your most unpopular opinion just when it comes to software engineering? Like what does Sabine believe that nobody else seems to be talking about enough?
Well, I have a very unpopular opinion about the OCaml community, but but about software engineering is really, really hard because I don't think there are really such unpopular opinions. I think you always find a group of rabid zealots who will say like, yes, this is what we believe in.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think there's a lot of unpopular opinions, if for no other reason than so many opinions in programming happen to have like a 50-50 split or a seemingly 50-50 split.
Yeah, but then you have two popular opinions.
Yeah, no, that's true. It depends, I guess, on where you draw the line at unpopular.
probably. I don't know. I'm not even such an opinionated person. I just like databases.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've tried every I know you wouldn't say every functional programming language, but I would, just because if we count the long tail of functional programming languages, like
it's endless. It's endless. I have never tried them in the way that someone who really wants to understand the language does. I always have tried them in terms of like, how would a person try this who just wants to build something?
That's
who just
the wrong way to
care.
Use functional languages, Sabine. Like that's not what we
I don't
here.
Know. I think it's the right way to use functional languages. But like the right way to use any language is to find the subset of the language that is readable, understandable, and maintainable. I think that's the challenge with every language.
I agree. Yeah, that's going to happen.
And for some people, it's more like, oh, I want the mastery over the language. I want to understand and use every language feature. But I have problems with that, because when you use every language feature, you require everyone else on the code base working on this to know every language feature. This is kind of raising the bar in a way that's not necessary. That's also why Go, in my eyes, is a pretty good language, simply because it has such a low ceiling in terms of features. The people who want to go deep in mastery of the language, who want to use every feature of the language and deploy it to production, they are going to get bored with Go. They move on to other languages where they can do that. And that leaves you in Go the people who are just focused on like, oh yeah, we don't really care about these deep language explorations, but we care about shipping. And I love that. So I really want to onboard Go devs to OCaml, because that's the spirit that OCaml needs.
That's the spirit. I love that spirit. I need to do more with OCaml. Yes. And actually, I think that is an unpopular opinion in certain circles. And what I mean is, and it's important to point out, because I work with a lot of like new entry-level developers, particularly learning backend. And there is an assumption that to be a really good developer, like you said, you want to spend time mastering every nook and cranny of a language. And in languages like JavaScript and Python, like, I am of the belief this is a fool's errand. There are way too many features, most of which you don't care about. And most of them, even if you did know about them, you would probably, like, if you know about them and you're a good engineer, you probably want to ignore them, right? Yeah. Because it's just been cruft built up over, like, 30 years of adding language features. So, and I do think that even with a language as simple as Go, like Go is famously simple with how few features it has, it's not that you learn all the language features, it's that you learn what you can do with them. And like, for example, concurrency in Go, there's a few language specific features like channels, mutexes, well, that's not really language specific, but channels, right? And you can understand what a channel is in just a day or two of working with channels, but to understand how to build like maintainable programs that work with channels, like that's years and years of practice. So,
well, imagine the years and years of practice learning how to use channels in Rust. So you don't just have one channel, but you have 10 channels, and then you have 20 mutex types or something like that. I mean, I'm observing that firsthand. I mean, I've never done this, and this is not a rabbit hole I will ever go down to, but I have someone here in the house who's writing an embedded system on some kind of Rust web application thing, and let me tell you, the questions about channels and async, I mean, it's wild. This should not be so hard for a simple web application thingy. I mean, yes, if you need the utmost maximum performance, then you get it with Rust. You absolutely get it. I mean, Go will never be that fast. OCaml will never be that fast. But when it comes to shipping something fast, I think the Go's and OCaml's of this world, they have a leg up in this. So it's just so much simpler to write code in the presence of the garbage collector when you have a single channel type and a single single kind of mutex, or well, the handful of mutexes that are actually useful in practice and meaningfully different, and not related to being meaningfully different in terms of ownerships and memory management.
This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on, Sabine. Where can people find you? Where can people find OCaml? What are the resources that you want to plug the most?
Well, I obviously hang on Twitter. And, you know, I also happen to hang out on the OCaml.org GitHub repository. So OCaml.org a lot. I sometimes open issues, but currently it looks like the demand for these issues is much higher than the number of issues that I can create. Just like because people are currently interested in learning OCaml, and it is kind of a cool way to learn OCaml when you can contribute to the official website. It's kind of cool, right? I mean, I would be tempted if I weren't working there.
That's really cool. So the issues are actually getting closed faster than you can open them. Am I understanding correctly?
I only recently learned to write good issues. So I've never been an open source maintainer. I was always a very much a proponent of closed source in terms of like when you're a solo dev, well, the last thing you want to do is give people access to your code.
Yeah.
you know, you obviously you use open source and sometimes you contribute back a little if the opportunity presents. But usually you are just closed source. But Taridis is very much an open source company, and it's a cultural change. So I've never been a maintainer before. Growing into that role is super interesting, like figuring out like how do I need to write this down? Like what do I need to tell people? What's the outcome of the task? How can you do this?
Right.
I don't know.
Very cool. Well, go follow Sabine on Twitter, ocaml.org, ocaml.org, GitHub. Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes. Thank you for having me. That was so fun and also so interesting.